Well, I had a dream last night, and I know it's a dream because I've been preaching for over 40 years and it's never happened. I dreamed that I got up and said, hey, all month we're going to be talking about money, and the church applauded. And I know it had to be a dream because, again, it's never happened. So I would like for you all to make my dreams come true this morning, all right? Now, wait a minute. That was good, but you jumped the gun. Throughout this message, I may see if you're still with me. So, hey, we're going to talk about money today. Awesome. I love that. Thank you. Charlie and Karen Scott went to a small town fair, and they noticed that one of the attractions at the fair was a stunt plane with a pilot who was willing to give people rides for money. So Charlie asked Karen, hey, you want to do this? And she's like, yeah, that sounds good. We've never done anything like that. And so Charlie asked the pilot, well, how much is it? And the pilot said, well, it's $100 a piece. So $100 for you, $100 for your wife, that's $200. And you know Charlie, ha, we ain't doing that. Come on, Karen, let's go get a caramel apple for a dollar. That's what Charlie said. So the pilot said, well, don't run off. He said, I'll make you a deal. I'll take you both up for 5 minutes. And if neither of you make a sound, not only will I not charge you $100 a piece, I will give you $10, sir. Well, that lit Charlie up. $10 my way? Absolutely. Let's get on that plane, Karen. So they did. And as soon as they got on the plane, that stunt pilot took off, and he flipped that thing around and upside down and over, and he rolled that plane, doing his best to make Charlie and Karen scream or make some noise, but nothing. Nothing. So they landed, and the pilot came up to Charlie and said, I got to hand it to you. Congratulations, you are a brave man. Here's the $10 I promised you. And Charlie said, yeah, it was tough. I almost screamed when Karen fell out of the plane, but 10 bucks is 10 bucks. Now, you all know Charlie. You know that could be true. Come on. So we're going to start this series called If Money Could Talk. And I can hear it already because I hear it through the ears all the time. Well, every time I go to church, all they talk about is money. If that were true, if the handful of times over the years that you attended church, all they talked about was money, I've come to two conclusions. Either you have incredibly bad timing, or you need to be in church more often. Because that's not all we talk about, but we need to talk about it. And there are some popular cliches that give insight to our view of money. You've heard them. Money doesn't grow on trees, right? Money makes the world go round. Time is money. Another day, another dollar. And it's easy to think that everybody has their money act together except for us. That's what we think. But the truth is, whether you have lots or whether you have little, many of us struggle in this area. Like one guy said, our neighbor's furniture goes back to Louis the 14th, and ours goes back to Sears on the 15th if we miss another payment. I think the biggest surprise in this series would be the parallel between what our money would say if it could talk and what Jesus actually did say about money when he talked. And Jesus talked more about money, Corey mentioned this in classes, than he did about heaven. That's true. Track it scripturally. He talked more about money than heaven. He talked more about money than salvation. He talked more about money than faith. He talked more about money than love. So my model for preaching is Jesus. And if I'm going to cover the subjects that Jesus covered, then we need to talk about our money today. I was introduced to the biblical teaching concerning money at an early age. I can remember when I was in Sunday school, the teacher gave all of us this scenario, and I still remember it. She said, if you had $1 million, I think we were fourth, fifth grade, if you had $1 million, would you give it to a missionary? And all of us boys said, absolutely we would. And we meant it. If you had 1,000, would you give it to a missionary? And we said, yes, we would. If you had 100, would you give it to a missionary? And we said, yes, we would. And then she said, if you had $1, would you give it to a missionary? And everybody in the class said yes except me. And you know why I didn't say yes? Because I actually did have $1. It's a little more personal when it's actually something you have to give. So in this series, we're going to let money speak to us four times, and here's what it's going to say. Today, if our money could talk, it would say, I can add meaning to your life, but I'm not the meaning of life. Next week, if it could talk, it would say, the moment you think you own me, I actually own you. Week three, Jimmy's going to cover that. If our money could talk, it would say, my direction reveals your ultimate affection, And then we're going to close out the series right after Thanksgiving. And our money would say, what you choose to do with me speaks volumes about who and whose you are. So let's jump into this. And don't tune me out, because we're going to talk about money today. I'm already starting to lose you. I can feel it. Today, our money says, I can add meaning to your life, but I'm not the meaning of life. So let me give you a simple outline. You know this, but it's good to be reminded. First of all, money is a tool. It's a tool that we've borrowed from the master carpenter. And Jesus tells a parable in the Gospel of Luke. I was sharing this with Corey. This is one of the strangest stories Jesus ever told. And you may be even thinking, after we read it, like, what in the world is he trying to say? Well, I'm going to try and help explain to you this strange story Jesus told, and it'll lead us on this discussion of if our money could talk. Luke 16:1, Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. All right? So we got a rich man. He's got more than he can manage. He hires this guy to take care of his stuff, and he gets wind that this guy is doing some side deals, and he ain't happy about it. Next verse. So he called him in and asked him, what's this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer. So he tells the guy, you're fired. Like Donald Trump, you're fired. That's what he says to him, all right? But before you go, I need you to tidy up my accounts, finish my business. Now Jesus has everyone's attention because he's such a good storyteller. Verse 3. The manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master's taken away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm too ashamed to beg. So the guy's like, great, I'm going to be without work in this economy. Are you kidding me? I ain't going to be able to make any money. I'm more of a pencil pusher than a ditch digger. I still have my pride. I'm not going to beg. So what am I going to do? So he's got time to try and figure out a plan. And he comes up with one, and it's interesting. Look at verse 4. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. So he comes up with a plan to make sure when he's no longer employed, he's got some friends who are going to step up and say, hey, you can come live with us. Look at what he does. Jesus continues. So he called in his master's debtors. These are the people that owe his boss money. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take the bill and quickly change it to 400 gallons. So in other words, the fired manager, while he's finishing up accounts for his former boss, says to a guy who owes his boss 800 gallons of olive oil, you know what, we're going to cut you some slack. Just cut that to 400. Now, the Bible doesn't show that man's response, but you know what it is. Seriously? Dude, that's awesome. Man, you need anything down the road, you call me, because I can't believe you're giving me that kind of discount. Man, you got a friend if you need one. Well, the guy ain't done yet. He goes to another one, and he says the same thing. Check out this verse, verse 7. How much do you owe my employer? He asked the next man. I owe him 1,000 bushels of wheat, was the reply. Here, the manager said, take the bill and change it to 800 bushels. So he did it again. And the Bible doesn't tell us that guy's response either, but you know what it is. Seriously? I don't have to give you all of it? Just part of it? Dude, hey, what can I do for you? So he's building up all these friendships because he knows he's going to be out on his ear pretty soon. And he's going to be able to go to these people and say, remember when I cut your debt in half? I need a place to stay. That's what he's doing. Now, at this point, these people who are listening to the story, you know what they're thinking? When that manager finds out, he's going to be hot. Right? I mean, if you were reading this story for the first time, you would think, dude's in for it when that manager finds out what he's been doing. But it totally goes a different direction. Check out the next verse, verse 8. The rich man, the boss, had to admire the dishonest rascal for being so shrewd. What? When he found out that the guy he hired was cutting what these people owe him in half, instead of being upset, he's impressed. And nobody knew what to make of what Jesus was saying. The audience was confused. They didn't get it. And many people who read it now don't get it. So Jesus pulls out of the parable to make a point. Verse 8, for the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light, the Jewish people who have the promise. He's saying the people of this world, they're not giving thought to eternity. They're trying to make it through today. And his ultimate teaching could be summed up this way. The money manager was commended for taking advantage of his limited time and opportunity. Sometimes Jesus will only work in these stories to give you one thought, and you can't get sidetracked by all the other things going on. He wasn't commending the man for being dishonest. He wasn't. He was thinking, okay, this guy's pretty shrewd. He doesn't have his job left very long, and he's making the most of his time. And Jesus wanted us to know we need to do the same thing. Our time is limited. It is. Every one of you and your family has experienced something that indicates to you that our time is limited, right? And so is our opportunities to do things for the Lord with what he has given us. That's the only lesson Jesus wants you to take from this story. I was 8, 9 years old, and my mom and dad would let me ride my bike to Mamaw's and Pa's house in Pleasant, Indiana. It was a 4-mile bike ride from our house, and that was about the age they let me start getting out on the road. We don't have as many people on the road down there as you all do here, so it wasn't that big of a deal. And there was a store at the 4-way stop in Pleasant, Indiana, called Shorty Morton's. It was S&S Grocery. There's the little store right there. That Coke machine has been there for years and years. And we'd ride our bikes up there, stop at Shorty's store. Shorty and Jean Morton own the store. They're both gone now. Wonderful people, good neighborly people. Before I was old enough to ride my bike there, my mom would take me in Shorty's store because he had a big jug of suckers. And he would let every kid that came in the store reach in the jug and pull out some suckers, a handful of suckers. So I did this for a couple years. And then finally one time we went in there and Shorty said, "Hey, Four Eyes, grab you some suckers." But I just said, "No, I don't want to reach in there." And come on. What's wrong with you? He said, "Well, I'll get some for you." And he reached in, he dug out some suckers, and he put them in my hands, and out the door we went. My mom said, "What is wrong with you? You're not shy, I know that, so what's going on?" And I said, "I figured it out. Shorty's hands are a lot bigger than mine." And one day I realized it. You know, if I let him get a handful, it's going to be a whole lot more than if I get a handful. And my mom in the car, she's like, "That's tricky. You're being tricky." Well, I didn't know this story that well at the time, but I would say, that's shrewd. That's what that is right there. I mean, I'm taking advantage of my limited time and my limited opportunity. And Jesus' point to the church is we have limited time and opportunity, and money is a tool that we need to use, borrowed from the master carpenter. It's not only a tool, it's a test. Now, don't get mad at me here, because money don't lie. It's a test of your love, your loyalty, what really matters to you. It's a measuring stick of where your heart is. That's why Jesus said, "Where your heart is, there your treasure will be also." And if it could talk, it would say, "I can add meaning to your life. I'm not the meaning of life." We get stuck in this hamster on a wheel cyclical pattern. Earn, consume, throw away, repeat. Earn, consume, throw away, repeat. And before you know it, consumers become consumed and spenders become spent. Now, in this strange parable, there are two different characters that we can identify with. That's different from all of Jesus' other parables. Usually, we only identify with one. We are both the debtors who have had our debt cut, and we are the managers who are to manage what God has given us. And I have preached this verse until I'm as blue in the face as my shirt is, Psalm 24:1, and I'm still not convinced people believe it. So I want you to say it with me, because I think that helps me to believe that maybe you actually do believe it. Let's say it. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. I'm not convinced. Let's say it again, but let's highlight the word everything. Get loud on that word. Can we do that? The earth is the Lord's and
everything
in it, the world and all who live in it. Where's the qualifier there? Where's "this is the Lord's, but this is yours"? Where's the qualifier? Where's the exception? Where's the addendum? Now, I'm a simple preacher, so I read a verse like that, and I think, okay, let's start listing some stuff that's in the world. How about your car? Everybody has a car. Belongs to the Lord. How about a motorcycle? Some of us have a motorcycle. Belongs to the Lord. How about a boat? Some of you have a boat. Belongs to the Lord. How about a bank where your money's at? Some of you have some money, belongs to the Lord. How about all the trophies that you have accumulated through the years because of your abilities that were given to you by the Lord, belongs to the Lord? How about food? JC store or the corn out in the field from the farmer? All of that belongs to the Lord. How about a house? Belongs to the Lord. You're married, you have a spouse. She belongs to the Lord. And I know this doesn't take you guys off the hook. One guy told me, well, he can have her. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Bad attitude right there. Your very breath, the air in your lungs, belongs to the Lord. Your children belong to the Lord. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And all of the things that you were given to manage, all those things on the screen, they're a test. Now, I won't point an accusing finger, but God sees more than I do. How you doing on that test? Malachi 3:8 was drilled into me when I was a kid. I think Jimmy will probably cover this verse. Malachi asked, will a man rob God? Question, yet you rob me. But you ask, how do we rob you? In tithes and offerings. Stealing has become a way of life in America. Employee theft accounts for 60% of all losses in revenue. That's a billion and billions and billions of dollars. Theft is prevalent in all of society. Stanley told Evelyn once that they needed to fire their maid. You all are probably surprised to hear they had a maid. Said he caught her stealing towels again. And Evelyn said, which towels? And Stanley said, the ones we took from the Holiday Inn. My parents raised four boys according to the letter of the law. And of all the sins that Mom and Dad Fugate hated most, there were two that rose to the top. Stealing and lying. And by the way, those two usually go together. Stealing and lying. My mom came to my older brother Mike. He's a year older but no wiser. And she looked him right in the eye. And she was giving him that mom lie detector test. You ever get that from your mom? I mean, you can't do anything but tell the truth because your legs are shaking and you know what's coming. And she said, she had this big jar of change in her bedroom. It was there all my growing up years. And we knew, like wet paint, do not touch. We knew that was the rule. Filled with quarters to the brim. And she asked my older brother, did you take the quarters? And he answered and he said he didn't do it. And then the big dummy offered additional information. He said, you need to go ask Mark. I say snitches need stitches. That's what I say. So she came and asked me. It's amazing the things you can still remember. I don't know how old I was, but I was wrestling in my head. Will I get spanked harder for stealing or for lying? That's the debate that I was having in my head. Because whichever one I would get spanked harder for, I wanted to say the other. I wanted to go the other way. And then I realized she ain't gonna be happy no matter what. So I said, well, I borrowed them. At that point, the high sheriff of the Fugate household gave me a lesson that I will never forget. She spanked me so hard that my hide would no longer hold shucks. You ever heard that? And I'm here to tell you, I learned a lesson because she wasn't going to raise a thief in her house. And we could go down there today. She's still there. I'm 61 years old. She could stack up quarters to the tune of $500,000 on a table, and it will rot before any of her boys think about touching it. You didn't want to steal from Rose Fugate, and after reading Malachi 3, it's obvious you don't want to steal from God. Now, Malachi mentions a direct way to steal from God with your offerings and your tithes, but there's an indirect way, and that's to claim ownership of things that clearly aren't owned by you. You may have been confused because you saw your name on a title somewhere, or you may be confused because your name's on a mortgage somewhere, or you may be confused because you pulled yourself up by your own bootstraps, and you made it what you did, and you have what you have, and you may be confused because everyone refers to all those things as your things, but the truth is, everything is God's. Everything is God's. You ever bought your kids something and then tried to get them to share it with you? Like McDonald's. If your kids are like mine, you got really familiar with menu item number 6. You know what that is? That would be 10 chicken nuggets. I bought Jayla 10 nuggets, and then on the ride home, I reached over to take one. One! One out of 10. That's a tithe. One! And she pulled them back and said to me with attitude, "Hey, those are mine!" And I sit there wondering how she came to that conclusion when I'm the one who got her the nuggets in the first place. She couldn't have even drove to McDonald's without me. I paid the money. I went through all the effort. I bought her the nuggets. And I'm thinking, don't you realize I'm big enough to take those nuggets anytime I want? Do you realize I could bury you in chicken nuggets if I wanted to? Do you realize I could get that 20-piece chicken nugget and not give you one? I just wanted her to share what I had shared with her. But it seems our children have learned from watching our actions toward God. Because God looks at us and says, don't they realize I'm the source of everything they've got? Don't they realize I have the power to take what they have away from them? Don't they realize I could bury them in blessings if I wanted to? Don't they realize I don't need anything they have? He just wants us to use our limited time and limited opportunity to use the money he has given us. And I have to tell you this morning, church, those are his nuggets. You wouldn't have them if it weren't for God and God's effort. Let me keep hammering this point home. Because God owns it all. He has the right to whatever he wants, whenever he wants it. It's all his. Because an owner has rights. We don't have rights. We're not really owners, not when it comes to God's stuff. As a steward, we only have responsibilities. So how you doing on this test? Money's a tool, money's a test. Let me close with this. Money's a trust. You ever wonder why Jesus spent so much time talking about money? Because he knows it becomes the issue that clarifies where our trust is. Let's do a quick history lesson, and then we'll close. I love history, and we're not the first to put our hope and trust in an economic system or the first to be deceived that money is somehow the meaning of life. Here's the back of a $1 bill. I blew it up so we could study it for a minute. Anybody know the history of "In God We Trust" on our currency? The use of that phrase first appeared in 1864, right in the middle of the Civil War, when Salmon Chase, who was Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury, got a letter from a Pennsylvania minister. And the minister in Pennsylvania thought, we need some reference to God as a national motto. And that's where the phrase, "In God We Trust," originated. Years later, that phrase found its way on U.S. currency in the thick of the Cold War. Around the same time and for the same reasons, "Under God" was added to the Pledge of Allegiance. And part of our culture war on godless communism, some of you remember those days, a 1955 congressional vote elected to place "In God We Trust" on our national currency. I'm glad it happened in 1955 because I rather doubt that it would happen now. Now keep looking at the bill. The most prominent iconography on the $1 bill is the eagle and the pyramid. I've always seen these, never really understood what they were all about until years ago. I thought, I'm curious. They constitute the Great Seal of the United States. The pyramid is a throwback to ancient Egypt, but it's a much tamer version than the one founding fathers Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin wanted to put on the $1 bill. They wanted a pharaoh going through the Red Sea with the water coming in over him. That's what Franklin and Jefferson wanted. They wanted a model, and they preferred this as the motto: "Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God." Ben and Tom were a little in your face, King George. How about that? So Benjamin Franklin loved that version so much of the seal that he adopted it for his own personal motto: "Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God." The final design for the Great Seal was accepted by Congress in 1782. Presented by Charles Thompson, a Philadelphia merchant, who finalized the design and included the Latin inscriptions on the pyramid. You know what those words mean? They're on your money. "Novus Ordo Seclorum," which means "a new order" or "a new government," and "Annuit Quaestis," "God has favored our undertaking." It's so fitting that our money carries the phrase "In God We Trust." That's like Jesus saying, where your heart is, there your treasure will be also. It's probably the one area that highlights just how much or how little we really do trust God. And I'm not judging, I'm not condemning. What you give, what you own, none of my business. I'm just reminding you, there is a source, and you're not it. There is a source to everything in your life. How much do you trust God? I always said if somebody could look at my day planner and my checkbook, they could probably tell what's important to me. Where I spend my time, how I spend my money, they could tell what matters to me. Our time is so limited, and God wants us to honor Him with our treasure and to start today. Our money's a tool, it's a test, it's a trust, and if it could talk, it would say, I can add meaning to your life, but I'm not the meaning of life. I don't know if you've been to New York City. On Fifth Avenue, in front of the RCA building, is the statue of Atlas holding the world on his shoulders. At the other end of Fifth Avenue is St. Patrick's Cathedral, and they have a little statue of the boy Jesus, and look what he's holding in his hand. He's holding the world. So I decided to put those pictures side by side because it's a clear choice, right? You can continue to carry the weight of the world on your shoulders, and that's what many are trying to do today, and that's what we will do if we believe that money is the meaning of life. Or we can say, Lord, here's my life. Here's everything you've entrusted to me. Here's my world. Hold it in your hands. And He will. He will. Amen.